Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 350. And for 350, we had to go big, right? I've got the man, the myth, Taron Egerton as my guest this week. This was a dream come true. Me and Taron have chatted a bit on socials, and I'm a big fan of his work, as you'll hear from this conversation. And we managed to sit down chat. It was in one of the windows of lockdown where we were able to get a secure and empty space and sit 2 meters apart to have this conversation. So we got to do it in person, which is pretty cool. But it was wonderful to sit down with Taron. If this is your first time tuning in, previous guests that might appeal, we talk about Stephen Graham in this episode. He's been on twice. Michael Fassbender, James McAvoy, Sophia Batella. I don't know who to list. There's so many good people. Mary J. Blige, Spike Lee. You know, I'm stumbling now, but just have a scroll through the back catalogue, and you'll see some wonderful, wonderful, wonderful people. Joe Gilgan, last week's episode with Maxine Peake, Kathy Burke, Vicky McClure. Anyway, a long list of wonderful, wonderful people. And I'm delighted to add to it with Taron. Oh, I should mention, I've had Mark Miller on, the creator of Kingsman. So that's well worth a listen. And Joe Hartley, who was in Eddie the Eagle, had loads of good people. I'll stop plugging. I mean, how can I not mention my boy Garth Jennings, writer and creator and director of Sing? Basically, almost everyone that we mentioned in this podcast I've had on previously. Before we get into it, I need to mention that Out of Her Mind, a new TV show written and created and starring Sarah Pascoe and me and Carrie Ad Lloyd and Juliet Stevenson and Aid Edmondson, is out on October 20th, 10 p.m. It's every Tuesday at 10 p.m. So check it out. It'll be on BBC Two and on iPlayer. Let's get into the podcast. This is episode 350 with the one Taron Egerton. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. And we're rolling. Right, I'm here today with Taron Egerton. How are you, man?
I'm all right, mate. I'm not bad, yeah. I'm getting by like everybody else, really.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's fine. I mean, you know, comparatively speaking, I'm, I suppose, doing well, you know, healthy. All, you know, the people in my life are healthy. It's just this kind of feeling of a bit of the joy having been taken out of the world, you know?
Yeah, and the limbo of it all.
Yeah,
and the appropriate limbo, yeah. Again, I don't think we should be rushing anything.
No, exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's really important, isn't it? But, God, you know, I would like to sort of feel like things are beginning to... I mean, it does, I suppose, you know, with the kids going back to school and everything. But, yeah, it's tough.
Yeah, it's weird. Have you been able to do any work in this period?
I mean, you know, I've read scripts and, you know, I've had conversations with prospective employers and... filmmakers, what have you, but again, everything is, in my case, I know it's beginning to change for some people, but in my case, things are still in that more hypothetical phase. I feel like it's probably quite likely that I won't work until the new year now. I was due to start filming something in September, but it's been pushed back to the new year.
Yeah.
I know you're off soon, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm off to do some bits, but again, it's because we're lucky that we were shooting in Canada, where they've just before I flew back, they'd locked, like, every flight coming in was a 2-week quarantine from anywhere in the world. And they've had that from the start. So they've been really good at locking down a bit more. And there's like, when I go out there, I've got to have a 2-week quarantine. And there's like a tracker app on your phone. And you literally can't leave your apartment, all that kind of thing. So
what will your shopping gets delivered to you?
Yeah, all that kind of thing. And I'd imagine because it's been going on for 4 or 5 months out there, I'd imagine they've got all the delivery services all on point.
I'm sure.
By now, there's going to be no panic. So I'm relaxed about it all. But yeah, it's an interesting one. Have you been in London or have you been out in Wales?
No, I was in Wales. What happened was on the 18th, I had a phone conversation with somebody I work with an agent I worked with named Jonathan Sanders, and he said he seemed to be privy to more information than I was. I was sort of sat here with my girlfriend not knowing what was happening. Yeah. She production had shut down for her. And he said, I think if I were you, I would get out of London. Because no one really knows what's going to happen. And I thought, I did. We packed up my van and we hot-footed it to Wales. Thinking, I felt like it might be 6 weeks.
Yeah.
And we were there for nearly 5 months. And
how was that?
Do you know what I have to say? I mean, Ceredigion, which is the county I'm from, has, like, I think the second lowest number of cases in the whole of the UK.
Right.
Don't quote me on that. It's certainly in the absolute lowest sort of quartile. But so it felt, certainly at that time where people weren't moving across the country, obviously it started to relax in July. But prior to that, it kind of felt a bit like we were in this bubble. It's also a quite an older population there. Mm-hmm. So people were taking it very, very seriously, as they should. But it kind of felt a bit like, I sort of equate it to, you know, it felt like we were in the Shire and Mordor was very far away and bad things were happening. So it was actually nice. Of course, there was a sort of underlying level of anxiety and you're aware that people are getting really sick and dying. But selfishly speaking, I did really enjoy just kind of disappearing for a while. It was very near my family and we were able to sort of see them a bit in the garden when the Welsh weather allowed.
It doesn't always.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, it was nice. Did a lot of reading and kind of just, I don't know. I think I've had such a manic few years, really. You know, in my 20s, really, I've been kind of manic. And I think I felt like as the world sort of came to a halt, I just found that I could sit still a bit more and kind of do things that I hadn't been able to do for a while. I said I read a lot and I only say it because I haven't read for a few years. I've just found it really hard to zone in and focus and something about...
Find yourself rereading the same page over again because I'm not taking this in,
And then you get paranoid thinking, is Instagram ruining my brain, you know? And that fear actually a while ago had led me to removing Instagram from my phone because I just scroll nonsense, you know? Yeah. And so I just keep it on my iPad and do it when I need to do it.
Perfect.
But yeah, I just found, for some reason, about 4 weeks into lockdown, I picked up a book and just really settled into it. And it just felt like having a warm bath. It was so nice. That facility just came back to me, you know?
Yeah. And was it nice being back in Wales? Because you grew up in Wales, right? You were born in Liverpool, but quite early moved out to...
My parents are from Liverpool. I was born near Liverpool, not Liverpool proper. And my mother and father separated when I was two or three.
Mm.
And my mother moved to North Wales to study, basically. So she would have been like... She was pretty amazing, actually. She would have been about 26, I think. And she went to get a degree and raised me on her own. And and she did it. Got first class honours, got a good job, and that was kind of the start of our life in Wales, really. And then when I was 12, I moved to Aberystwyth, which is where my grandmother lived, and she'd moved from Liverpool about 6 years before that. So, I mean, I've never felt particularly scoused, although weirdly, sometimes I do sound it if I'm drunk or angry. But
I love it when those things pop out.
I went off on a tangent there.
That's great. And it's lovely out there. I used to visit Lampeter a lot, which is just down from Aberystwyth, obviously.
Absolutely.
And
what were you doing there?
Oh, my brother was at university at Lampeter. Okay. And he had a little cottage in the middle of nowhere.
Gorgeous, though.
And it was just amazing.
Yeah.
The first few times I went, it was when he was there. And then it became a thing that whenever he came back to Essex, I'd go and just have his cottage to have that isolation. Because, again, if you've grown up in cities, you don't have that. Again, it's what... Obviously, it goes without saying that this pandemic is horrific. But if you're trying to find the positives, I think it is when it's making people who don't normally pause take a moment to pause and take a breath and take a look over things. I think we've built a society and the entertainment industry at the peak of that where we're told that if we stop for a second that we're lazy or we're skiving off or whatever else. And it shouldn't be that. Society used to be built around leisure being really important, work being important too. But for years we were pushing towards a 3-day week or a 4-day week. And that was the goal of a positive society, that we have to work less. Whereas now I've had it myself for years. I've always been that I need to be constantly working.
Yeah.
Otherwise I'm throwing away opportunities. I'm not being grateful for the opportunities I've had. But again, I think this period again, particularly in an industry that doesn't allow you to pause, you always feel if you miss a job, then you're throwing everyone will forget about you.
Yeah. I mean, I really, really felt that. I felt a change in me. And of course, I don't wish to sort of belittle the severity of what's happened. I'm just mean, very selfishly speaking, I found it to be quite cathartic. And I don't know, it did something to me that I think needed to happen. It felt like a slight reset button. And I think other people have experienced, well, you're saying that you recognised a bit of that yourself.
Completely. So what was the route to acting from, single parent upbringing in North Wales, or then with, grandparents and that in Aberystwyth and that kind of area? It's not somewhere that looks like it's got obvious options, but there has always been amazing actors from those areas, from those parts of the world. So there will be people to look up to and see it as a thing. But
yeah, I mean, I think, when I was in North Wales on Anglesey, it wasn't remotely a consideration in my life, the way that I socialised with my friends.
That's literally off on an island, right?
Village, with the village with the longest name. It's that one. Yeah. Please spare me from having to do it again. So I grew up there and had an incredible set of friends and was a very happy kid. But, what we did was play football every day. And to be honest, I enjoyed it, but I always sort of felt a bit like I was going along with what everybody else wanted, and it wasn't really, it didn't set my soul on fire. What I did do privately was I did like a lot of very solitary creative stuff. So I was very, very into drawing, and I was very into, I remember when I was maybe about 9, there was a little shop in a nearby town called Bangor, and they sold these little squares of clay, different colored, and you could piece them together and then fire them in an ordinary oven, acting like a kiln. And that just, like, it completely blew my mind, really. So I ended up they're still in a box somewhere in my mum's attic, and certain family members have got them in little cabinets or whatever. And that's what I spent my time doing, was making these little figurines. I was very, very into animation, very into, Aardman and Pixar. Yeah. And that's what I did, really. And then we moved to Aberystwyth when I was 12, and I had about three years of a really rubbish time, because I just struggled to adapt and make friends. And and so those kind of little private creative pursuits continued. But, I think I was probably quite good when I was 12, and then my sort of skill level never really developed beyond that.
Yeah, yeah.
And then when I was 15...
This looks like it was made by a 15-year-old, and then when you're 18, this still looks like it's made by a 15-year-old.
And then when I was 15, Aberystwyth is very lucky to have an incredible facility, which is run by the university, called the Aberystwyth Arts Centre. All of a sudden, when I was 15, I just made a couple of friends. There were people who'd sort of vaguely been around, and I decided to join the local youth theatre because it's what they did. It was sort of apropos of nothing. I'd always been creative. I suppose I'd always had an interest in drawing and creating characters, but I'd never thought, now I'm going to be those characters. Yeah. And I joined youth theatre really because it seemed like a way of fortifying burgeoning friendships. Initially it was the source of a lot of anxiety. And I've told the story a lot, but I'll very briefly say it again. The first play I did was A Midsummer Night's Dream, and I played Flute, who's one of the mechanicals, and he's a character who has to dress up as a woman. Yeah. Now I would relish that, appropriation of the female form or not. I would enjoy that. But at that age, it caused me a lot of anxiety.
Right.
And I remember they made me a sort of, there was a lady named Oriel Martin who did all the costumes, and she made me a red tutu and a sort of wreath of flowers in my hair. And I remember on the first night stepping out in that costume in the last act of the play to just people falling about in hysterics. And that was just a moment. I just knew, I was just like, this is the absolute best. This is the best thing. This is the best thing ever.
Yeah.
And since then, I've wanted to be an actor, really. So continued doing that youth theatre for a couple of years, did lots of things, played Seymour in Little Shop of Horrors, and we did a production of King Lear, and I played Gloucester. I must have been the youngest Gloucester ever at 17. various other bits and bobs. And then in my late teens, I auditioned for drama school and ended up going to RADA. Yeah.
And how was that? Because, again, big change from being out in Wales to being in RADA, where I was speaking recently to Maxine Peake about this.
Oh, yeah, well, she used to come back a fair bit, actually, and talk to
us. Yeah, and she still does loads of good stuff there. But she was saying there's an element, because my view of RADA is very inaccurate, I guess. I used to go to spoken word nights all around the country, and there was one that was at RADA, and it always felt so posh.
Yeah.
And it felt like every time I'd get up, it'd feel like they were letting the staff have a go. But from what Maxine was saying was they've always had a good history of getting people from all sorts of areas
she's right,
and having a real mixture. So was that the case for you? Did it feel kind of welcoming?
Well, I think sometimes what happens with RADA, a slight sense of grandeur and earnestness is mischaracterized as poshness.
Yeah.
Because actually, it's a really great cross-section of people.
Yeah.
You know, there's a real mixture of ethnicities, of cultural backgrounds, of, you know, there's people from, not even just from the UK, you know, people from, you know, there was a Greek girl in my year, and there was a girl who was from Turkey, or at least one of her parents was from Turkey, and there was a girl from Brazil, and, you know, it was, so in that sense, it felt very kind of diverse. So I never felt, there was a couple of people who'd come out of Cambridge or Oxford or whatever, and were, you know, very educated and well-spoken, but it felt like a real healthy mix. And they really, really looked after me because I was from a household that had income, a household income under 25 grand. Mm-hmm. I got like a lot of my fees paid. You know, I couldn't have gone otherwise, you know. Yeah. When I auditioned for 5 drama schools. And, you know, I had to, immediate members of my family gave me like 40, 50 quid for each audition because you have to pay to audition.
Right.
And, you know, it was a real family effort to get me to those auditions.
That's beautiful.
Oh, no, it was, I mean, you know, my family, they are, you know, amazing. And, and then when I actually got to RADA, they really supported me. There was private benefactors and stuff who give money to support students who can't afford to go through the drama school. So I think, you know, I think there is a sort of slightly outdated idea about RADA being this kind of very sort of hoity-toity place. And that wasn't my experience of it. Look, I mean, I would say candidly, there's, you know, I think the place has some, it certainly did when I was there. I haven't really been back. It had some stuff that it needed to work on. And I didn't always love my time there, but I never identified that as being a problem with it.
Yeah.
You know, as sort of an elitism. I didn't feel that.
Yeah. That's really interesting. So to kind of, I mean, as you've probably heard before, we go all over timelines on this.
Yeah.
To kind of rewind and jump forward, having been that kid making these little figurines and characters, how was it to then work on like Dark Crystal and Moomin Valley and stuff like that would have been stuff that you were possibly aware of at that time?
Totally, mate. And I think that, you know, that that's exactly the appeal. It's the same thing. And that's why I love those. It's why when someone says, do you want to come and voice a character in something, I run at it like a bullet, a red flag, because there's something I really love about that, you know, creating an entity that's unlike anything in the real world, and being a part of giving it a voice and giving it a soul is really, really exciting. And it's so inherently collaborative as well. I think there's something quite humbling about doing voice work because, you know, you're one cog in the machine. Whereas, you know, sometimes when you're on set and if you're playing a big role, you know, you can feel a bit like you're the center of the universe.
Yeah,
and of course it's completely absolute nonsense, but you know, there's something I really like about voice work. I think it's quite a nice exercise in humility, I think, as well. And I just love the creative process of it. It's hard as well. That's what I like about it. I think it's deceptively difficult. Have you done much yourself?
I've done a few voiceover things during lockdown because I've got a studio at home. So there's a few things I was like, oh, I can do this. But I did a voiceover for an animation that has still never seen the light of day, but it was with Joe Gilgan, James Acaster, Brett Goldstein. And it was such a good crew of people, and the guys who were making it were friends of Gilgan, and I assume they've just had other projects have taken over, and it'll get there one day. But it was one of my favourite days of work because it was exactly that: we're just all in a room doing it at the same time. It was it was only a 20-minute thing, so we could do it over the whole day, just keep workshopping it, keep changing it.
Yeah,
and I adored it because it was, you don't have all those other elements, as you say. And it's interesting because you say about how when you're on camera and maybe in an important role, you could get a false sense of importance.
Yeah.
But that's because they need to get you in the best place to give your performance. They need you to not be worrying about your tea or this and that. So I believe it's it can be seen as pampering, but then when you realise some of the great performances that we've seen in cinema,
yeah,
that couldn't have happened if they were thinking about anything else at all.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think the reason that's come in film and TV is to release as many of the unimportant worries.
I think where it goes wrong is where people start turning up 2 hours late to set, and that's where it starts getting a bit...
I've seen that as well.
Yeah, I think we're all that. Where that starts getting a bit distorted, I think. But... yeah, you're exactly right. It's the same appeal for me, you know, making silly little cartoonish figurines and doing the voice work. I love that thing.
And the interesting thing is, because none of us are on camera, I really enjoyed the enjoyment on other people's faces as someone's doing a really good line.
Yeah.
Because you don't have to be keeping in a straight face or whatever. And I remember there was a particular bit where I had to read out a really big number. And it's this ridiculous...
Yeah.
Blah, blah. And every time it would start to build up, I'd intentionally deliver it so it's kind of building up in anticipation as you get to the end. Every time it got to the end, everyone's face kind of being like...
Yeah, I know.
As we continue on, which you wouldn't be able to do on set. You have to hide all of that on set. Yeah. You have to have that internally. So how was it getting your first big moment where you are that centre of attention? Kingsman really threw you into the limelight. I was so excited about it because I'm a Mark Miller fan.
Yeah.
I love the comic books.
You've had him on the show, haven't you?
Yeah, I've had him on. I think he's absolute genius. I love his outlook. He's so relaxed and casual about everything. And he's created some of the biggest...
He's a big kid, isn't he?
He is.
Yeah.
He's a massive kid. So, and then when it came out, I loved it because all my family are South London. It's got that very South London feel and there's a lot of that in it. How was that to get that role and then have it all on your shoulders as such?
Yeah, I mean, it was you know, it was insane. It was both the most thrilling, exciting, joyous thing. You know, oh my God, I'm leading a film with Colin Firth and Samuel L. Jackson and Michael Caine and Mark Strong. But the pressure of it was, I mean, you know, it was massive.
Yeah.
And it was very early on in my relationship with Matthew Vaughan as well. You know, I would cautiously say now that I sort of think of him as family and I love him very much. But at that stage, he's quite tough in some ways, Matthew. And
it was a pressure one for him as well, though, wasn't it?
Because
it was that kind of going out on his own kind of.
And it was financed in a very particular way as well that gave him a degree of ensured authorship, I suppose. And so I think there was a degree of pressure on him. I think, in fact, I'm sure had he not had that sort of degree of control, I don't think I'd have made it to the screen, frankly, because I was an unknown. But I was 23 and I am a sensitive little thing, and I found it hard, you know, the pressure of having to get into really great shape, the pressure of having to play what I always felt was quite a character part, and I suppose, you know, it was a tough time. I also broke up with my first girlfriend at that stage, and that was, you know, I was 20, she was, you know, we'd been together for 2 years, I was 23, and it did what it does to a lot of people, it really tore me apart, really, And so it was a tough time.
But again, this is an industry that doesn't allow for the real world.
You've got to put it, you've got to leave it at home.
There's no, I'm struggling at the moment. It's like, cool.
Yeah.
Your call time, 6 o'clock. See you then.
No, exactly. And I have to say.
Hope you're okay.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, and do you know, there was one day where I did have, you know, a conversation like that with the producers because I was in a bad place and I was around my 24th birthday, I was hitting it quite hard on the weekends and then also training and then coming in and, you know, I mean, frankly, looking like a bag of shit, really. And there was one day in particular where Matthew was just like, we can't shoot you. You don't look good enough. You know, because I look really rough. And I was, but I was just, I'm 30 now. I still feel like a kid, you know, I was definitely a kid at 24. And the pressure of it, I was releasing pressure in the wrong way. And I quickly sorted my act out and got it together. But it was a lot, you know. Anyway, I don't wish to paint a negative image of what making the first Kingsman film was like. Cause frankly, it was, you know, it felt like winning a golden ticket to William Wonka's Chocolate Factory. And it was absolutely amazing. I'm still very proud of the movie. I think the, you know, one or two elements of it that time won't be kind to in terms of
I agree. But
I think generally, you know, what it is a fun, provocative spy thriller with its tongue in its cheek. I think, you know, it's cool and I'm hoping we get to do another one.
And it was exciting as well because you, as you mentioned, it had that backbone of experience of Colin Firth, Samuel L. Jackson, Michael Caine,
yeah.
Mark Strong, all of these. But then it was you and Sophia Boutella basically having your breakout roles
yeah,
there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it came across so well. They were two characters that felt like I was looking back, and obviously I remember Kingsman. I was like, oh, what was he in before that? Because it felt like knew you.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Oh, that's right. How the film came across in my memory. I'm like, yeah. Well, yeah, that's Taryn and Sophia as well. I had her on the podcast a couple of years back, and I was like, I remember in that, but it, both of the characters, again, because they are kind of character pieces,
yeah,
they stood up so well that it felt like, oh, I know these actors, I know everyone else, so I must know these guys as well. And it's a.
Well, they were great roles, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I think particularly the role of Eggsy, just because, I mean, if you were to put a blueprint to it, it's Pygmalion, it's My Fair Lady, you know, it's that story of a guy going from rough around the edges to adopting something of a more refined persona.
Yeah.
I think Matthew very shrewdly dispensed with that very quickly. It's not like he starts all of a sudden speaking like Colin, but what he does have is a great arc. And it's so, you know, I think part of the reason that the world loves Marvel and other superhero movies is because it involves an element of metamorphosis and someone literally changing before your eyes.
Yeah.
And that's so exciting to watch. And I think Eggsy really had that. So where you go see him go from one very distinct look to another to becoming this, effectively a superhero with this bulletproof suit and this very slicked hair and, you know, these glasses and all the rest of it with the umbrella. It's exciting. And yeah, I really loved it. I mean, it was, you know, I think I'm forever going to feel like I owe Matthew Vaughan my career. And I don't mind that really. You know, we're still very close. He continues to champion me at every available opportunity. And yeah. But it was amazing, man. It was amazing. And when I saw the movie, I remember Matthew set up a screening for me, I think in Soho, and I took like five or six of my close mates from ABBA, maybe one or two others, and we watched it. And I'd always felt, not in a presumptuous way, but I'd always felt, there's something about this. This is cool. Like there was, I think it was to do with seeing Colin in a certain way and Sam playing this very zany villain and the turnaround with Michael Caine at the end of the film. And I just thought, yeah, people are going to dig this. But when I watched it, I was just like, fucking hell, you know, that is,
it's proper.
That's cool, you know? And so it was a really, really exciting time in my life. And I'm very proud of the movie and the character and all the rest of it.
Yeah, well, Mark still picks that as his favourite or equal favourite of the interpretations of his work. And so after it being a tumultuous journey in the making, how was it when it came out? Because it did, I'm a massive cinema nerd, and particularly of the cinema itself. I love the cinema experience, and it was a game changer because it invented this February release slot.
There wasn't
a thing before that. And Kingsman was the one that came out in a period where generally you don't release big films because they're all in the summer or a few at Christmas. And Kingsman came out there and was one of the biggest films of the year, and it literally changed how films are released now. There's always a couple of things in that February slot now. So how was that? Because even if you were excited about it, you probably couldn't have predicted how. I don't think anyone could, because the fact it was in that slot that was kind of a mid-year slot.
Yeah.
No one was predicting it.
But, you know, at that age, I had so little understanding of release dates and, you know, box offices and how all of that works and how it is such a motivator for the industry, or was. You know, at that age, I was just like, I was just going where I was told to go and, you know, trying to be charming and sell the movie, really. You know, I didn't have any concept of what they were hoping it was going to make. I didn't have any concept of the significance of the release date. You know, I knew we were going up against, Sam Taylor Johnson. What's the movie? 50 Shades of Grey.
Yes, of course.
And that was alarming. I knew that people were twitchy about that, but, you know, we really held our own and got a really good slice of the pie that weekend. And, yeah, it was this sort of, I suppose, relatively sleeper hit.
Yeah, I love it. So how was it, again, at that point you were playing newly created characters and character pieces, as I said. How was it to go on and do Eddie the Eagle, where you're having to portray someone in real life?
Yeah.
Again, people have different approaches of doing their own research or relying on the script. What was your approach to that?
I think, you know, that movie was directed by Dexter Fletcher,
who,
of course, has been on the show as well.
Yes, and, I love Dexter.
And there's something about, you know, Dexter's style of filmmaking, and Matthew's as well, I think, that there is a sort of slightly heightened quality. And I think with Eddie the Eagle, I don't think any of us were labouring under the delusion that we were going into it creating a sort of, you know, social network style. I mean, it's not really appropriate. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't a really austere, calculated sort of carbon copy biopic.
Yeah.
We wanted to make something that was like Cool Runnings or, you know, something that had that sort of 80s sensibility of fun, popcorn buddy movie with just loads of heart. So, you know,
which is right, because Eddie the Eagle wasn't
a
traditional celebrity.
You can't
make that serious drama his tough journey. Like, no, he was a comical character. That was the point.
Exactly. And I think we were more going for something that felt like an approximation of how people's affection for him rather than trying to emulate him exactly. So, you know, I'm there's moments in that movie where I'm much more cartoonish than Eddie really is, but you know, what we never wanted to do was mock him. It was always, you know, it's grounded with enough moments of proper drama, especially with the relationship with parents and also with Hugh's character. I think to earn those moments of comedy. But I felt that, I mean, I suppose had it been a really serious biopic, I would have been really, really skinny and tried to make myself look like an Olympic ski jumper. Yeah. And like, it just wasn't really what we went for.
No.
We were going for a sort of every man slightly cuter thing. But it was just the most incredible experience.
Yeah.
And there was just a sort of alchemy that happened in terms of, it's not very often, and Hugh said this actually, it's not very often that you have an amazing time on set and the movie's good. And we just had the best time.
I can also contest to that.
Yeah, sure. We all know it. And so, we just had this amazing time. Dexter and I clicked immediately. And then Hugh came into the equation. And I just found that for some reason, I don't think of myself as being a particularly funny bloke, but for some reason, I just had the facility to make Hugh crack up. And we just became very close very quickly and had a really amazing time. And we were filming in such a beautiful place out in Germany and Austria, Bavaria. And it was, you know, snow-capped, gorgeous. And then we came back to London for a month and it was just wonderful. And I missed it when it was gone, actually. And then again, you know, I kind of turned up to the screening to see the movie and I just thought it was fab. You know, I mean, not to be self-congratulatory, I just thought, God, I'm really pleased with that, you know? And I just thought he had bags of heart.
I was going to say, Dexter's amazing at finding heart in everything. Well, everything he's done, he's just got so much heart in there.
Yeah, he must have seen Wild Bill, he just has a lot of love and warmth in him. And also, you know, it would be remiss not to mention Matthew in the background as well, also sort of coordinating things and being a very creative producer. And he has such an incredible instinct for how to put something together in the right way. And so, yeah, it was wonderful. I think everyone felt a little bit, I mean, the world and his mum's seen it now, you know, on streamers or whatever. Yeah. But at the time, it didn't quite bring people into the cinema in the way we hoped, which, you know, I think some people were upset about. It didn't make a great deal of difference to my life in that moment, you know. But I was just so proud that we'd made something that I felt had loads of warmth and love in it.
I think it's similar from something I've experienced in music. If you make the art that you want to make, and it comes out how you wanted it, it doesn't really matter how successful it is. Whereas if you've tried to make a pop hit and then it's not successful, it breaks your heart because that's exactly what you're aiming for. So it's
exactly,
I think it's right to go that kind of, well, I get to walk away happy now. I've at the screening, it's not released yet. I've watched it and I love it. I get to walk away happy. Never. Now whatever happens next is
honestly
out of my control.
Never a truer word said, man. Yeah. I think you're absolutely bang on the money. And it's, you know, I think if I've gleaned any wisdom over the few years I've been working in film, it's just stay in the day, focus on the moment you're focusing on, give it your all, and don't try and end game anything, you know, and just let it develop, you know, into what, I mean, I think part of the secret to Dexter's success, and I'm not sure he'd thank me for saying this, he has bags of passion and bags of enthusiasm and works so, so hard, but I don't think he'd pretend that he knows exactly what he's making when he's making it. I think he lets it unfold because it's an inherently collaborative medium. You've got people, 100%. You know, specialists in so many different fields, And everyone fires on all cylinders when it's working well, and it's how that comes together. So how can you possibly know exactly what it's going to be? Maybe if you're a really autocratic director with, you know, gazillions at your disposal, maybe you can control everything to that extent. But in my experience of working with Dexter, that's not really his style. And I like that. I like the sort of, you know, let's kind of see what happens side of things, you know. And I feel like that really worked well for Dex on Eddie the Eagle.
I love when people have that, have the confidence to work like that.
Yeah,
I experienced it when working with Tom Hardy on a couple of things, and he was very much in this period, and again, it might have changed over the years, but was very much of the outlook of best idea wins.
Yes,
of course, and again, I've seen that on a few different things, and to have that on like the first thing I was on with Tom, if something isn't working, then best idea wins. And there was points where I've done two things and I'm throwing in ideas and they're getting through and it's going to work. And I've spoken to Stevie Graham about that, who we'll talk about later because you worked together on an amazing film. And he's said, I've been on things with like Scorsese or all these huge people. And you go, let's try it this way. It's not working. And to have that openness rather than to feel, if you acknowledge it's not working, it's a sign of weakness. You failed in some way, which some directors will have. It will be, well, no, here's how I planned it.
Yeah.
So here's how it's happening. Rather than go, it's not working.
Yeah.
We all know it's not working. Well, here's how I planned it. I'm right.
Totally. And I think it is such a killer of creativity that, you know.
Yeah.
I think that best idea wins is such a bit of wisdom. And, you know, anyone who works in film or theatre, you know, has come across people, I'm sure, where an idea kind of doesn't get through because it's not come from the right place or whatever, and that is just, it's just fucking bullshit, isn't it? You know, it's just, it is, you know, I actually have been very lucky. I haven't worked with many people who are like that, but I know it happens.
Yeah, completely. So, I mean, we've spoken about how the pandemic has forced everyone to take a breather and look at things. At this point, you hadn't taken a breather, so to walk into the opportunity to be up for the role of playing Elton John and then to get that, how was that? Did you have a moment to realise how much pressure there was in a way of that?
Yeah, because it happened quite slowly. So we were doing the second Kingsman film in the spring of 2016 and Elton was involved in that movie playing a sort of, very sort of crazy cameo and big cameo. And
An exaggerated Elton.
I didn't even know you could basically Matthew approached me about it, and I have really weirdly the sort of being the jumped up little novice actor I was, I asked my agents, because I share a team with Tom Hardy, we've got the same two of the same agents and the same lawyer, and I said, look, you know, what's happening with Tom's Rocketman? Because if this, for whatever, because it had been sat around for like 3.5 years.
Completely. It was bouncing back and forth for ages.
And so I said, look, if this ever comes back on the market, as it were, we got to get me in front of whoever the right person is.
It's one of the funny ones with someone like Tom, who is often so transformative.
Yeah.
It's not easy to just go, we'll go from that film to that film. Because if he's got a, like he did with Capone, if he's got to put on a load of weight
and do this and do that,
you can't then. Do you know what I mean? It's weird how that scheduling and stuff can end up working.
And I think that was it. I think it was a question of scheduling and he being the very busy man that he is. And, you know, and also I know Tom a bit. We've worked together and we've always stayed
in touch. Legends was a great one,
Because we got on very, very well on that. And you know, basically what happened was the movie kind of changed hands a bit, basically.
Yeah.
And by the time that had happened, Tom was, I think, like getting on for 40, and the character starts their journey in the movie at like 17, you know, 16 or something. And so they looked at other people. I think at one stage they might have looked at, like, I can't remember. They looked at various people anyway for the role. Yeah. But Matthew had gotten friendly with Elton and David on the set of Kingsman 2, and they'd obviously been having some sort of conversation about things. And he approached me on set and said, look, how do you feel about playing Elton? And I was like, oh, my God, I've read that script.
Yeah.
And that was the start of it, really. And then it was probably about 2 years before it became something that felt really real.
Yeah.
in the autumn of 2017, I started going into a studio with Dex and with Giles Martin, and we started singing some stuff. And in the following January, they filmed me at a piano doing Your Song and Don't Let the Sun Go Down on Me. And I didn't really know what we were doing. My understanding was that it was an attempt to sort of demonstrate or give a flavour of what we were intending to do.
Yeah.
I.e. have me sing and do a version of the character that isn't quite so, you know, it's not Bohemian Rhapsody or Ray, where yeah. they sort of use original vocals and someone doing an incredibly good impersonation, something that was a little bit more, I don't know, whatever the word is, rough and ready, I suppose. Yeah. And so we recorded that. And then it all sort of snowballed from there, really, and we started shooting in 2018 of that year. And it took up 2 years of my life, really, because yeah. there was so much. We were essentially recording an album as well as making a movie, so there was such a huge period of working before and after shooting, and then the whole madness of promoting and then doing a bit of the awards circuit, that it was a really, really long time. And I mean, just amazing. I just loved playing that part so much. It just felt like it afforded me so many different exciting things to do with the singing, and also making myself look so different, and also just playing somebody who changes so much through the course of the film, goes from being someone very shy and retiring to someone who's a fucking nightmare, and very difficult and erratic and addicted. And it was absolutely awesome. And I will always be so, so grateful for that opportunity. And it's a time in my life that I will always really, really cherish.
I love it. And what I loved about your performance was it highlighted, because again, Elton's known for his flamboyance, but particularly the first performances in like the club or whatever and things like that. Yeah. He's got the flamboyance, but you then realise, even if you go and rewatch his biggest performances, he's defiantly casual about it.
It's this
huge flamboyant thing, and he's very much just throwing it away.
Yeah.
And I thought you nailed that. Thank you. Getting that across of, again, you take to Freddie Mercury, every inch of his body is making sure, here's my performance, here's my moment. Whereas Elton wants to do as big a performance as that, but act as if he's just woken up. There you go. It's nothing to me.
Exactly. Well, I think, certainly by the time you're in the mid-70s, I think there was probably a fair bit of him just getting up quite late and bowing down there. You know, I think his life was in a sort of a barely contained state of chaos for such a long time with, you know, the partying. I think it was different. You know, if you talk to him about it, I think he felt like he couldn't really do what Freddie Mercury did, and he felt like he couldn't really do what Bowie or Jagger did with those cheekbones and that moving. And so his way of expressing himself and his brand of extroversion, if that's a word, being an extrovert, was to dress outrageously and to be quite outrageous and to be very provocative. And the moments in the film where I'm allowed to emulate that were really fun.
Did you find yourself thinking back to when you were at school and you had to put on that pink tutu?
You weren't
happy about it. Now you're like, I'm now at a place where I can revel in this.
No, 100%. And I think as well, you know, I'm somebody, you know, there are actors in the world who are, you know, always in phenomenal shape and are very considered about their appearance. And I just haven't got it in me. so I'm a little bit more, you know, I have moments where I'm in good shape and I have moments where I take great pride in my appearance. And I have moments where I really don't give a shit. And there was something about playing Elton that I found very, very liberating, because I was not deliberately not in the best shape of my life. But there's something very, very freeing about putting on a vest and a pair of hot pants and a gold bomber jacket and being what is essentially the most powerful person in the room. You know, there's that thing that they tell you at drama school where it's the king doesn't play the king, the court plays the king. You know, the king does whatever he wants to do.
Yeah.
And I sort of felt that way a bit about Elton at his ugliest moments, really. And I think he wouldn't blush at me saying that. You know, there's a freedom in doing. I feel like Elton, you know, at those bad moments, just can do whatever the fuck he wants. And that was quite fun to play with.
I love that. So how was that one to finally get to watch? Because again, what Dexter did with it was so unusual and extravagant. When I had him on the podcast, I wasn't allowed to mention it at the time, but I'm sure there's like
a certain amount of time has passed, so
yeah,
he can't get in trouble for it. But he took me into the editing suite because they'd just put together an edit of the bit where you fall into the pool.
Yes.
And then when it all just becomes this amazing, surreal scene.
Yeah.
And it was mind-blowing because I interviewed Dexter before the film had come out, so I hadn't seen the film and it was still being edited, obviously. But to see that, I was like, oh, this isn't... This isn't a Social Network.
This isn't
a regular biopic.
I absolutely adore the Social Network, by the way.
It's one of the best of all time. But it's a good example of that. Yeah. Here's your more serious version. Here's your... But again, it wasn't Eddie the Eagle. It didn't take it lightly.
No.
It was just...
I think it was a slightly more sophisticated movie in terms of what it was dealing with, and also our sort of... Tonally, it was more grounded. I think about the most absurd it gets is where I'm backstage at the Troubadour and I have my sort of first strop. That's about as kind of farcical as it gets, I think. But yeah, you've got to give credit to Dex and Matthew and also George Richmond who shot that sequence. It's quite visionary, that little bit. It's a really weird moment and I've not really seen much else like it. And what's great about it as well, I listened to Himesh on the podcast the other night and he was saying, about Nolan's work and about how you have these very quick, snappy cuts, but they're all imbibed with a real moment of story. And I think, it's really true of Nolan's work. And I think that moment in Rocket Man, that sequence, it tells such a great story because, it's a story of someone who's not really keeping it together, but is being patched up by the vehicle around him and then being ushered on stage. And I don't know. And then he sort of, shoots off into the sky like a rocket, which is amazing because some people laughed and some people are sort of shocked and some people kind of get emotional at it. And I mean, I think if you can get one or two moments like that, that's a real triumph because it's resonating with people in a way that that they don't really understand. Yeah. And I think it's to do with them being properly empathetically engaged. And I just, first time I watched that, I was like, oh wow, yeah, that's cool. That's
completely it. I love that. I love that. The point that it's causing a reaction that you may not understand and you don't have to. I think there's a problem at points with the way modern cinema has become is that we have to explain everything and there has to be this explains that and this links to that. And that can be great, but if you walk into a gallery, you can see a painting and love it and not
know
why. There's something about it that you love. There's something visceral.
Yeah.
So finding those visceral moments rather than, how are we going to explain that he turned into a rocket and shot up into the sky. It's like, we don't have to. It's not about that. It's about those moments of...
Totally. I think that's, with big commercial studio filmmaking, as Rocketman was, that is always the battle, because there's always a pull towards something more binary and something more, as you say, explainable and rational, because that's quantifiable, and quantifiable is what makes big business models work.
Yeah.
And actually, the best art, quite often, is where you watch it and go, I don't quite know why I just watched, but I really loved it.
Yeah.
And I'm not really sure how I feel about it, but I feel something and I know I'm going to be thinking about it for quite a while. And I think Dex and I were both quite passionate and bullish about trying to get a sense of that into what was otherwise quite a commercial endeavour. We were coming off the back of Bohemian Rhapsody, which had made $1 billion gajillion or something. Yeah. So everyone was getting very hot and bothered about Rocketman doing the same thing. And, exactly as you said earlier, if you don't end game, you were saying about doing what feels good to you and what feels creatively sort of authentic to you, and the rest will fall into place. And I'm really, still, 18 months on from the release, thankful to say that, the movie that arrived on screens is the movie that we wanted to make. And of course there were some compromises, but I don't feel like the integrity of it was ever compromised. And
Dexter feels like the perfect person to be going into to battle to make it the film you want it to be, because he's an argumentative fucker, and he's not going to be intimidated or in awe of people. He's obviously respectful, but he will be.
This is
how it's meant to fucking be.
No, we had some heated conversations about stuff, there was stuff that we really felt passionately, and in credit, to the studio and David and Elton and Matthew and everybody, everyone did the right thing, and I think preserved it and as for what it was meant to be, which was something that felt raw and at times painful, but also celebratory. It was never meant to be, heavy in a way that inhibited your enjoyment of it. But it wasn't. I mean, it's a movie about a drug addict, getting well, so it's not. There's only so light you can make it the whole way through,
Yeah. I love it. Well, this next bit I've noted down, and it's going to feel a bit shoehorned in because it is, but it's a topic I've not had a discussion with anyone on. And I've argued with some mates in the past, and just things I've read online, when there's actors who will say that they don't want to do a gay scene.
Right.
Or they're not comfortable doing a gay scene. And
right.
I call bullshit on it, because you do a love scene, it's acting.
Yeah,
it's the
yeah.
characters are in love. Yeah. I'm happily in a relationship. I will happily do a love scene in a film
yeah.
if it comes up, because it's not me, it's the character.
Yeah.
Equally, I will happily do a gay scene in a film
because yeah.
it's not me, it's the character. So it's kind of, I've had some awkward conversations with mates who say, I wouldn't feel comfortable, I don't feel I'd perform it correctly. It's like, well, either you're lying about a normal love scene only being acting,
yeah.
or you're being kind of homophobic in,
yeah.
in not being comfortable with that. So how was that to kind of embrace that? Because again, everything felt so natural in your performance of Elton. It didn't feel like there was any scenes that felt like it was trying to be, here's our moment of, we're okay with homosexuality. It's, like, it's just yeah. a key side note in his story as such.
Yeah, and it's a tough one, you know, because I think there's a really interesting conversation about, you know, how valid it is for straight actors to play a gay role mm-hmm. and then receive, you know, great adulation and, you know, as if there's some sort of great triumph of transforming yourself into a gay person, whatever it
yeah.
means. And so I'm keen to play it down, because I don't quite know what the answer to that question is.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I still don't feel it's clear cut, but I understand the question and I yeah, understand yeah. the debate. With regards to that scene, you know, I don't know. It was just, it was part of the story. I felt like it was an important part of the story.
Yeah.
I'm not in any way uncomfortable with physical intimacy. I don't think, you know, I can't really figure out. I mean, look, you know, I've done other love scenes before and they're horrible. They are, you know, heterosexual,
yeah.
homosexual, you know, masturbating on your own. It's just not a fun thing to have to do on camera. So it was, you know, I'm very, very lucky in that Richard and I really clicked very, very quickly when he came on set. And it was just something we got on with and did. And,
yeah.
And it, you know, I think it's really beautifully shot. I think it's a really important moment in that character's coming of age and his awakening. And that's that, really. But I don't think it's anything to be massively commended for. I think it's really, I think what is commendable is that It was in the movie,
yeah.
and it made its way into the movie. But for my part, I'm not sure that, I don't know, you know, it's just part of the gig.
I completely agree. You know. I completely agree. And again, it's that thing of, there's loads of things that you've got your unusual days. Like I did a film a while back on my first day on set. It got moved forward. So I literally came from the Eurostar straight onto set. And the first scene was me masturbating, but trying to not make it look like I'm masturbating, because they're only Lovely. Seeing me through a keyhole, and they're trying yeah. to, they think I'm building something, but in reality the reveal later on is I was wanking. So again, that, to walk straight on set, haven't met anyone, to be like, right, now you need to look more, no, less like you're masturbating now, yeah. no more like you're masturbating.
The problem is, that's the first impression as well, so you're always the wanking guy.
Yeah,
that's rough.
Exactly, but yeah. again, that's exactly where all love scenes and all that kind of thing should sit together.
Yeah.
I think you're completely right. It shouldn't be singled out as a different thing or even a greater consideration. As said, I'm not sure if I'm comfortable with this.
No.
Like, no, well, if you're comfortable, you're comfortable with your...
I think what's more, you know, relevant is, like, is it important to the story? Does it yeah. serve a purpose? I think and hope that it was satisfying
yeah.
for people who are, you know, not whatever the, you know, what's the phrase, cis hetero, whatever,
yeah,
the phrase,
yeah.
you know, to see a love scene done in a really, you know, a tender, lovely way, and for it not to be made a big thing of. I mean, yeah. unfortunately, it was made a big thing of before the movie came out because of an article that was released in the, I think it was the Mail, and that was a shame for a while, because I felt a bit fucked off about it, because it was like, well, the point is that it shouldn't be something that we're all talking about loads. The point yeah. is should be to normalise it, and by sensationalising it, it almost does the opposite. And so I felt that was a shame, but that just shows that we're not living in a world where everything is as sane and right as it should be yet. You know,
yeah.
just the existence of it in a big studio movie isn't enough. You know, you'll feel like you're really reaching, I don't know what the bloody word is. It'll feel like stuff's better when it goes by without people noticing. Do you know
exactly
what I mean?
That. And with that in mind, like, how do you feel about where cinema is going at the moment, because again, I do think we've had a lot of progression in recent years for, again, for generally non-white cis male characters. So with the progression of female characters, with the progression of all different races, there's still a long way to go. And again, the point is that it has to get to that point where it's not felt like it's a big deal.
Yeah.
It's not felt like it's a marketing
part of
the film. It's the female superhero or it's the black superhero. That's a great part of it, but that shouldn't be the reason you're making it.
No.
It should be because these stories need to be told and need to be represented.
I think, you know, we are still in that stage where there is a cynical element to a lot of that, but I think that's probably a stage we have to go through. And, I mean, it feels like there is a... I mean, I can't, you know, certainly in, you know, the Western world, I mean, at the moment, it feels like there is a real appetite for things to shift and to have a greater level of diversity and opportunity for people who aren't white blokes, really. Yeah. And I think that's, it's so, the air is so buzzing with it, isn't it? I think it is and will get better. I think it just needs everybody to, I was texting an actor yesterday, actually, because I saw his movie Clemency. He's an actor called Aldous Hodge, do you know?
Yeah, I know. Yeah,
I've seen Clemency.
Yeah,
it's great. Really great. That's why I texted him. And we met at the start of this year, and I haven't spoken to him since. And we just briefly touched base on the state of the world, and he said something. I'm paraphrasing, but he said something that really stuck in my thought about. I said, you know, it feels like things are and will change, and that's exciting as long as everyone's got their eyes on the prize. And he said, yeah, I think the way to think about it is 2020 is the year where we all need 2020 vision. And I thought that was quite a cool little mantra in terms of reminding yourself that vigilance regarding making sure that there is equal representation, I mean, from my perspective in the world of film, and making sure that the films that you work on embrace that philosophy. I think that's what's required of us all now, you know.
Completely. I completely agree. Well, I mean, we're getting to the hour mark, so I'll start to wrap things up. But one thing we have to talk about is Sing.
Because
I absolutely fucking adore it. I had Garth on the podcast, and we'd not met up until then. We got some mutual friends, and we've really hit it off on the podcast to the extent that when I was shooting a film in France a while later, I popped and visited him on my day off. And on that visit, I talked about the annoyance I got off people that Sing was proud, or confusion more, that it was in my Films of the Year list. Because Films of the Year lists are often so highbrow.
But
I go off what I got the biggest buzz off watching in the cinema.
Yeah.
And Sing was one of them. And I discussed it with Garth, so I won't rehash it too much. But so many people, myself included, I can't enjoy reality like talent shows because I'm too cynical. I know that there's a formula and they're playing me.
Yeah.
And I know that they'll play this particular song and it'll make me start
to pull the heartstrings.
But then it is a really good formula and it is really good to get those emotions. So to have it in this animated film to allow you to use all those things and not have to hold back because you feel you're being manipulated. Of course you're being manipulated. It's film and it's animation. They really had to slave over every moment of it. So
I think the difference is, you know, these are characters who are having those journeys that you are manipulated into feeling in real reality television.
Yeah.
But the feeling is that because it's a completely fictional animated world, you don't have to feel guilty about the real people who are really being manipulated.
Exactly.
And, you know, I think some of those big talent shows over the years have obviously really tread and crossed that line between exploitation of people.
Hugely.
And so seeing, I think, aside from the fact that it's a massive, you know, commercial film, it's less cynical, I think.
Yeah.
You know? And so you can enjoy it a little bit more guilt-free. I mean, I got that part. I auditioned for that part when I was 24, I think.
Yeah.
And I knew that there was... I wasn't told who the other actors were, but I knew there was... I was told that there were a couple of big stars involved. And so they asked me to go and audition, and I could pick a song. And I think I did Otis Redding, These Arms of Mine. And I got the part, and you know, Skyped with Garth. He was in Paris, which is where the animation houses, the studio is, Illumination. And it's just fab. It was just such, again, harking back to what we were saying earlier about, you know, loving the animated stuff. I was just in my element. I adored it. I remember the first day they showed me a picture of Johnny, and I was like, oh, that is just awesome. And then, you know, again, had a little private screening for some mates. It was bigger that time. There was about 40 of us in there. Dex was 15 minutes late.
Yeah.
not that I'm bitter about it. But, yeah, and I just thought it was fab. I loved it. I was really pleased with it and proud of it. And we're now working on a sequel, which is really cool. In fact, I'm pretty sure that my work is done, actually. I've been
amazing.
Yeah,
it's such a long process, isn't it?
Yeah,
that was another thing that was amazing, visiting Garth at Illumination.
Yeah,
him showing me some of the processes, and then even then, that was a good few years ago, and at that point he was starting to get to work on Sing 2, like they'd been given kind of the thumbs up,
and
all
it's
very
cool.
secretly and quietly, but yeah, it was like, here's what I'm doing now, and it's like, wow, that's a good...
It takes time. You know, I think we that movie came out, we premiered at Toronto in 2016, which is exactly 4 years ago.
Yeah.
And I think now the plan is to release this new one at the end of next year. I think, you know, depending on what happens in the world, it would be truly amazing to launch it at Toronto again, because we had this incredible, like, series of spontaneous rounds of applause during the final act of the movie, because it is so joyous.
Yeah.
And so it would be great to try and, I mean, maybe a folly, but it would be great to try and recapture that experience next year at Toronto, but who knows. But what the direction they've taken it in, obviously it's more than my life's worth to talk about it, but the direction they've taken it in is so cool. It's just a slight spin. And
great.
I'm really excited about seeing the finished article.
I can't wait. How nerve-wracking is it when the song selections start to come through and you start to find out what you have to sing? Because with Elton, obviously, you've got to sing all Elton songs. So once you've realised, right, I've got Elton just about, then any of his back catalogue, there'll be some learning, but you know you've got it. Whereas with a thing like Sing, where they can pick any song from any genre, any era, and you have to go, all right, go ahead.
I mean, I think it's funny because obviously they want stuff, they pick stuff that they think kids are going to vibe with, you know, and has that sort of joyous, buzzy, I suppose quite poppy feel to it. And so, you know, I of course always want some sort of soulful ballad, but and didn't get it. But, but you know, I trust Garth and Harvey Mason Jr., who looks after all the music. You know, those guys, they've done it once before, they know what they're doing. And I recorded my big song recently, actually. And, it's cool, I think. I think it's going to work really well. I think, you know.
And how was that? Was that over Zoom or Skype or something now? Because previously Garth went
No, to Garth did a lot of flying around. So Garth was, we were on a live link. So Harvey's in LA.
Yeah.
Garth is in Paris. Yeah. I go into a studio in Soho.
Great.
And basically you have to wear a mask until you get into the booth.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, they encourage you to sanitize your hands pretty regularly, but it's mandatory when you go in and mandatory when you leave. And, you know, it's all pretty locked down, as it were.
Yeah,
but yeah, you know, there was an option to do it from home.
There couldn't really be a much safer place than a vocal booth.
No,
because it is this kind of airtight. You can make sure it's cleaned out beforehand.
Exactly. And they, you know, they sanitize it both sides of the session. And, you know, it is what it is. They said that I could do it from home. You know, there's a way that they could have a team come here and set up a booth, as it were. But
Nick Frost was having that recently. I was talking to him recently. He was saying, because he was going to come back on the podcast. He's like, well, actually, if you hold off, I've got this gig I'm doing, and they're coming and building
a booth. Right,
hold off and we'll do it once I've got all their kit.
Good idea.
Just over Zoom or whatever. But that's the two variations, I guess. You could have had it all there. But then I think, like, people often talk about, particularly if you're self-employed or self-motivated, it helps to have an office to go to. Do you feel that helped with going to a studio to do it, rather than just being in your house and going, I guess I've got my phone call in a minute, I'll go and do my song?
100%, and you know, I think that's one of the things that I really focused on during lockdown, was, you know, trying to give yourself structure, you know. So very strict about not having a beer during the week and waiting till the weekend and doing,
that with pizza. At the weekend.
Yeah, but how do you do that? On your off menu podcast, the first one, I was like, this guy eats like I eat.
Yeah.
But you've got that annoying metabolism thing.
No, that's it. I had that annoying metabolism thing. As soon as touring,
you felt that it started to leave?
I exercised so much more now, because I didn't realise. I thought it was all metabolism.
Yeah.
And then I realised,
it's moving.
For basically 6 years, I was gigging 3 to 5 nights a week, or 3 to 6 nights a week. And because I was always energetic live, that's a 90-minute workout every night.
Yeah.
And as soon as I stopped touring, suddenly went, oh, it wasn't metabolism. I was just exercising loads without realising.
Yeah.
So
When did you stop then?
I stopped doing music 5 years ago now. Again, the plan was to give acting a go. I wanted to spend a year focusing on trying to get into acting.
Yeah.
And then the first gig I got was on a Guy Ritchie thing. And I was just like, amazing. I want to do this forever. This is, I've spoken about it once
before. Was that The Gentleman?
No, I was on King Arthur.
Oh, right, cool.
Cut out completely. It was, as you may have seen, it was one that was 2 years in the edit. There was a lot of changes.
Yeah.
And I didn't make it in it at all. But just that experience of being on there and seeing how it all works and working with some absolutely amazing people and going, this is what I want to do. And it was the first thing I had a breakthrough moment of everything else I've done in my career. I've always thought, well, there's a time limit on this. Whereas acting was the first one I was thought, imagine how much better I will be in 10 years.
Absolutely.
And in 20 years.
Yeah, and you always again, feel like you're growing.
There'll probably be a financial peak.
Yeah.
But from the artist's point of view, you're like, I can imagine being a 70-year-old and doing this and being in love with it.
Yeah.
Whereas I couldn't imagine that with performing music or a lot of these other things.
Well, I can't really speak to the whole, you know, to many other art forms, but with acting, I do think that is part of the joy of it, that you do have these realizations as you do it, where you kind of feel like you're leveling up.
Yeah.
And you go, oh, that's that thing. That's why I'm coming stuck on this bit. And that, you know, and it's because I've not really thought about it in this way, or it's because I'm not committing enough to it, or I'm not giving enough energy to it, and I'm trying to do it in a back foot way. But that's not what is required of the character at this moment. The biggest one is listening, you know, and not focusing on what you're doing and trying to put the focus off yourself. And all of a sudden everything comes for free, you know. It's
100%. And one of the things that really jumped out when going back over your career in this, it's the people that you've worked with. Again, you've got to share that time and spend that time. And because I'm a big believer in you learn so much on set.
Yes.
I think that's a really big place to take
you learn
so
on the
much
job.
In.
Yeah, yeah.
Learn on the job a lot. I'll read so much. I'll go to classes, and I think they're all good for tightening everything and improving. But I still feel the big breakthroughs I've had have been when I'm on with Stephen Graham or
absolutely.
Someone like that, and he's going, "Here's a little thing. Have you just changed that?" And you're like, fuck, that's just changed. That's changed everything.
How good Stevie, eh?
He's amazing.
He's the best.
And he speaks very highly of you, him and Hannah.
That's nice.
How was it, again, on Rocket Man, you got to jump between so many different people, and Stevie was obviously in the office situation.
Stevie is somebody that I had, like everyone, really admired and feel is, you know, a national treasure and just such a person to aspire to be like, in terms of not only his ferocious talent, but like his humility, his decency, his warmth, his kindness. You know, when we were on the set of Rocket Man, he, my family were down visiting. He set them up to go and have a tour of, I don't know what it was, Tower Hamlet with Beefeaters or something.
Yes,
he set
that'd
it up.
Be with our mate Andy.
And you know, it was just like, he didn't need to do that. And so we really clicked in here off, and we stayed in touch, and and I'm looking forward to getting some dinner with him when we're slightly back to normal. And you know, he's just somebody that I watch, like, you know, the virtues, you know, for my money, I don't think I've seen a better bit of acting than that. Like, I don't know where it is. You know, I watched it and I was just so moved and blown away and furiously jealous of his ability, you know. But you know, he's amazing, and he is absolutely, you know, for me, someone to aspire to be as good as and be like.
Yeah, completely. So I'll wrap things up with just asking what's ahead, if there's anything that you can talk about. It's always the toughest question to ask anyone in film, and even more so at this point in a pandemic.
there's two or three things that are still very much unfinished. So they're not things I can talk about, but I feel like this Tetris movie is going to happen in the new year. So I'm happy to talk about that a bit. And that's basically a true and incredible sort of true story about the rights to Tetris.
Because it's mind-blowing, isn't it? Because it was the Russian government had some kind of involvement
because
and control. It's this
because of, you know, state laws at that time, I think sort of basically everything belonged to the government, really, you know.
Yeah.
And I play a character called Hank Rogers, who is a game designer and involved with licensing games. And he, it's kind of mad, he becomes embroiled in a very complex, unbelievably kind of scary situation where the Russian government and the KGB are sort of contesting his rights to distribute the game.
Right, yes.
And there's another party involved as well, who I won't name for legal reasons. and so, yes, that's very, very exciting. It's been directed by John Baird, who did Stan and Ollie and Phil's, produced by Matthew Vaughan again. So that's cool.
Sounds great. And again, weirdly, it sounds like it, only from what I've read up about it, it sounds like it will be more along the lines of Social Network.
Yes, exactly. Because
again, you hear Tetris movie and you think Lego movie or Emoji movie.
No, no.
Something like that is very much not that. It's
absolutely
such a mind-blowing story. I remember reading up about it years ago and being like, this is insane.
How is this not a movie?
Yeah.
I know. Well, I mean, hopefully that all comes together. I don't know if it will feel quite as clinical and austere as Social Network, because Hank Rogers does bear some resemblance to Super Mario, but he did anyway. But I'm really excited about it. It's an amazing script, and I think it will make a great movie. And then The Sing 2 coming out next year.
Yep.
You know, the world feels like it's getting a little bit more back to normal. That I'll be able to hit the ground running and work a lot, because it's actually been 2 years since I made a movie. You know, Rocketman took so much of my time up afterwards promoting it and finishing the soundtrack off, and then we did the whole awards run thing, and I feel a bit creatively sort of starved, to be honest. I'm ready to get back to work, so hopefully that happens sooner rather than later.
I love it. Well, thank you very much for
your
time.
You,
it's been an absolute pleasure.
Likewise, thanks so much for having me on.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go. That was Taryn. I'm so glad we got to have that conversation. And I'm glad it was one of the few I got to do under safe circumstances in person. As said, we were incredibly careful. We got a safe, clean, spacious space to talk in. We've both had to have tests for other things anyway. So, it was nice and safe. And it was great to touch that. But yeah, I'm glad I got to have it in person, because we'd not met before. And he's someone who I'm a fan of, and we've gone back and forth. And something gets more cemented when you actually get to sit opposite someone and have a good chat. So yeah, I hope you enjoyed that. I'll be back next week with more wonderful guests. And I'll see you then. Ta-ta.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.